So I'm horrified when I think about the fact that Christmas is 2 weeks away. Not because I hate Christmas, I love it, but because I can't believe that it's that time of year again so quickly with everything that that entails. For many people, it is a joyous time of year, a reunion with family, the renewal of old traditions, whatever they may be. Same is true of Hanukkah, other winter festivals. For some of us, it's the solstice, a time of ingathering, a time of fighting back against the darkness. It's that family piece that apparently can be a little complicated at times. For some, and it's a blessing, that's just a joyous reunion. But for many people, we have to acknowledge that it's sometimes difficult to be around the table with the whole extended clan. And I've been asking people, so what are you going to be doing, you know, this season? Oh, I'm going back to New Jersey or whatever it is. And I, you know, always get, I notice this little eye rolling on occasion, or how's that going to be for you? Okay, you know. So we can see that there's some tension there. And what it seems to revolve around is that apparently there are some topics that we cannot talk about even with our own families. That's often what the source of the discomfort is. In the 9 o'clock service, I asked, you know, what are the sorts of things that people can't talk about? Some of them are, of course, very personal. You know, personal problems that members of the family have, or why Brother Bob can't be there, and that sort of thing. But in more general terms, there seem to be a couple biggies that folk who have difficulty sitting around the table at the holidays can't talk about. Any guesses what they might be? Politics. And another biggie? Religion. So guess what we're going to talk about today? Religion and politics. Indeed, in my own family, with my father, I actually perfected a certain kind of response to anything that came my way on those two topics, which was, I was trying to convey nothing more than, I heard you. You know, I didn't want him to even think that I had agreed, necessarily. Interestingly, that's the metaphor, that's the vision or the image I want you to have in front of you today, is sitting around a table, but there are some topics that we can't talk about. That actually, according to a couple of articles that I read that are the inspiration for today's message, is the very model of liberalism, of the liberal approach to governance and the liberal approach to religion. And I'm going to use that word liberalism a lot this morning. I don't by that mean it's kind of popular, you know, related to the Democratic Party or more left notion of, you know, conservative versus liberal politics or whatever. Now I'm talking about liberalism as kind of the great project growing out of the Enlightenment, as the great project of politics that is America, the covenant-based system rooted in the Constitution and so forth. That whole system of philosophical and political thinking that comes from the Renaissance through the Enlightenment. You'll remember the famous names from history class, I hope. John Locke, Rousseau, John Stuart Mill, his great On Liberty, which was a religious conversion experience for me. I became a liberal reading that for sure. And what this system meant on the political level, then I'll bring it over to the religious, was it evolved primarily as a mode for people to deal with religious differences. On some level, we could say it actually begins with Hobbes. Many of you will recall Hobbes, who, after endless years of religious wars in Europe, during the Reformation, and one king or duke would adopt Catholicism, another would adopt Lutheranism, they would fight. It was just a horrible, horrible mess. Hobbes named life nasty, brutish, and short. And it was. And thought, we have got to find some way to take this thing, religion, that is so good at dividing wedges between people and find some way to move it to the side so that we can live in peace. Now, Hobbes's solution wasn't the ideal from our perspective. He thought you needed a strong dictator to keep everybody in line. I'm trying that model here, but it's not going very well. So it grew up from that into Locke, and Rousseau and the notion that, well, maybe we can have a more democratic state, maybe we can divide powers and so forth. But the basic principle was the same. What it did was privatized religion. It said, let's make religion more a function of each person's own ownership and individual belief and not make it something that the state is going to have a say in and try and move it to the side. That's a big piece of what I'm talking about. But liberalism also includes everything that grew into liberal theology, and that's such an important part of our basic approach to the world as Unitarian Universalists, an optimistic view of human nature, a sense that there is progress in the world, that we're growing up, that we're going somewhere, the elevation of reason and our human faculties over revelation and magic and so forth. All right. Now, we have been called religious liberals since the very beginning of Unitarianism and Universalism, back in the late 1700s and the early 1800s. And so, although I may seem to be talking on some abstract level about politics, what I'm really trying to get at today is our sense of identity as Unitarian Universalists. What does it mean to be a religious liberal? Or are we liberally religious? Or are we people who have made a religion out of liberalism? I think that's actually what has happened. We may have even made an idol out of liberalism. And this is a back and forth kind of thing for me, because I think that the Unitarian Universalist experiment of trying to live in a just, loving community, an inclusive community, directly parallels the American experiment of doing the same. And indeed, our religious tradition and the political tradition of the country are intimately woven together. But a month or so ago, 2 months now longer, Ray Turfs, a member of the congregation, sent around an article by Stanley Fish, some of you may have read it, who writes for the New York Times, that was titled, Liberalism and Secularism, One and the Same. And in it, he referenced another article that I could not commend to you more highly by a fellow named Mark Lilla, L-I-L-L-A, called The Politics of God. Both of those are available on the web, and you can ask me about them later if you want to read them. And who made essentially the same claim, that liberalism is fundamentally a secular undertaking because of its attitude toward religion, which to me then begs the question, what are we doing here? Okay, if ours is the liberal way, what does it mean to be doing that while also trying to have a religious structure and a spiritual understanding of the world? Is there such a thing as secular religion? Is that what we're doing? What's going on? So I want to look at the American operation and use it as a metaphor for how we relate to each other in religious community. The thing about liberalism is that ultimately it is an overarching philosophy that basically does not have room in it for strong religious claims that would violate a basic structure that says we need to live in peace, we need to act with mutual respect toward one another, and that religion is a private matter that is best left out of the public sphere. And which does, I mean, of course, we know there are many religious people who are involved in politics and involved in public life, people who honor free expression and toleration and individual rights, elections, frequent elections, and who are also people of faith. But what we see is that the faiths that they profess, more or less, in the public realm, have to ultimately be fairly moderate, maybe even undemanding, not so bold in its claim as to jeopardize the basic liberal perspective. Stanley Fish wrote, "Liberalism, if it is to be true to itself, must refuse to entertain seriously an argument or a project the goal and effect of which would be to curtail individual exploration, self-realization, except in one direction, free expression and innovation. Closed-mindedness with respect to religions that do not honor the line between the sacred and the secular is not a defect of liberalism, it's its very definition." And that speaks to that privatization. Okay, you can have whatever faith you want, as long as it's not the kind of faith that says we should be doing something different besides liberalism. And of course, the challenge of the world today, the challenge of the country, is that we are confronted all around us by religious perspectives that take a very different view. And that's what these articles were about. How do you deal with folk for whom that's just not the religious perspective at all? We talk about having tolerance for all sorts of different theological perspectives, but I wonder about tolerance for the religious perspective that says, say, society needs to be built according to the book of Leviticus or the Quran or something like that. We tend to weaken in that perspective. And one of the costs of this privatized religion that many of us experience is that it makes it hard to take faith seriously sometimes. Our faith becomes another preference. Oh, you know, I like brown clothes and I like pizza and I like Unitarian Universalism. That's my own business. You know, I'm going to go out for pizza and Unitarian Universalism today and you can do whatever you want. But faith is maybe meant to be a little bit more deep than that. And that tension is readily evidenced. And I would like to offer, as a, perhaps a surprise example of this, Mr. Mitt Romney, who in his speech just the other night demonstrates the need to confront liberalism's demand, and America is a liberal nation in this capital L sense of the word, just undeniably so. We want our politicians, maybe not we, but America wants its politicians to be religious, but not too much so. Not too much. And so you get these kind of offensive, you know, throwing out of religious language that feels like some kind of, a manipulative flirtation or so forth. They have to use God often enough for the right audiences, but they can never say, you know, I will absolutely follow the teachings of my religion when I make my decisions and so forth. And here's Mitt Romney, for whom everybody might fear that sort of thing, giving, you know, his version of the JFK speech. He said, "Let me assure you, no authorities of my church or of any other church, for that matter, will ever exert influence on presidential decisions." So what does it mean to make moral decisions, leadership decisions, and set your religion to the side? I wonder that. He said some other things. "As governor, I tried to do the right as best I knew it, serving the law and answering to the Constitution. I did not confuse the particular teachings of my church with the obligations of the office and of the Constitution. I will put no doctrine of any church above the plain duties of the office and the authority of the law." He said, the classic liberal statement, "No religion should dictate to the state, nor should the state interfere with the free practice of religion." Now, that's great. And as a religious person, as a believer in God, as a person who loves the diverse expression of religion, I will say that that line, actually, between the sacred and the secular, at least in America, has been really good for us. It's been really good for America because we don't have a state church and none of us can get beliefs crammed down our throat, more or less. But it's also been really good for religion. This is a unique country in terms of how much diversity we have across the spiritual board, or and even beyond spiritual, into philosophical perspectives and non-believing philosophies and so forth. It's all got its place here because of the First Amendment. That's a beautiful thing. And we try and do something like that here, too. Make a lot of room for all of those things in a weird way by making a line that we can't cross. We do that own version of sitting around the table and not talking about things in our own way. I think I've said this before, but so forgive me. But often, the only time I find out where a person really stands in respect to spiritual matters or their philosophy or what they think the meaning of life is or what might or might not happen after they die or whether they felt their life was worthy or not is when they're sitting in a hospital bed. You know, rare is the opportunity to sit around the table and say, where are you really coming from? You know, what do you really want? What's the common ground that we're trying to build? We fall into those same traps of saying, that's your business over there. And that might be fine for the political realm, but for crying out loud, this is a religious community. You know, our effort toward a common good and a shared language should be a little more lively. Instead, what we find is that, you know, it's very easy for us to complain about all of the folks out there who are bad about their religion and so forth, and one of the byproducts of that is that it's very hard to be a Christian here, for example. It's very hard to be an atheist. You know, each any given group might feel like we're over here on the outside because there's no affirmation of the points of view because we so infrequently get down to really talking about it. And that is the challenge. And because of that connection between the UU experiment and the American political experiment, I think we have, I mean, I'll call it a calling, you know, a sacred calling to get busy with that work. Because if we can't do it, if we can't build something really powerful and lasting and free, when we are committed to so many principles in common, and do so out of a deep commitment to our own religious perspectives, then I'm not really sure what kind of hope there is for the world. And that was the point of these articles, which were so challenging. Mark Lila, in particular, contrasted liberalism with what he called political theology, where for people, you know, God isn't a private thing. God is actually commanding how society needs to be, and that's how it has to be. And so some of those basic liberal principles aren't even part of that perspective. Stanley Fish again said, we can't appeal to common ground with some political theologians. There is no common ground, because the basic principles of tolerance, mutual respect, and diversity are ones that they have already rejected. And invoking them will do no real work except the dubious work of confirming our own feelings of superiority. We're tolerant. They're not. And that is another one of the Achilles heels of liberalism, arrogance. Certainly heard that in Mr. Romney's speech, I must say. He needed to turn those critical eyes, perhaps, to his own country, much as our job as critics is to turn our critical eye on ourselves. The use of reason and critique in liberalism is meant for our own inward reflection and judgment, and not to feel superior. A little joke from James Luther Adams, one of our great theologians, he said, we happily announce to all that we do not possess all the truth, but only we are sure the most advanced truths available. Ha ha ha. But if that's the perspective we're coming from and people are way over on the other side, how are we going to meet? I mean, that is really the question before us. And I don't know that there are any answers. The challenge of the article said that the best we can hope for is to cope, is just to cope. That forget the kingdom of God, forget the peaceable kingdom, forget, you know, the ideal democracy. Maybe all we can hope for in this world is to manage those differences, but also to get adept enough at communicating across religious boundaries so that when little doorways open, we can throw in a little bit of our shared humanity and a little bit of the common good and continue to invite people into a more inclusive perspective. So here we are then, trying to live this liberal lifestyle, this liberal mode of relating to each other. How are we going to do that and really express ourselves as people of faith? How do we acknowledge the rights of others to have their beliefs while still rooting ourselves deeply in our own fundamental truth? That is the question before us. And I don't think we can escape it. I think this is our work. Because there are things we believe in common, and we need to carry that out to some extent with the same level of conviction as people who would oppress others or cram their religion down people's throats. Only the thing is that what we have to carry forward like a torch, you know, like a bright shining light, is that love is better than hate. That tolerance and mutual respect are sacred callings that trump selfishness and envy and fear. If we're going to use God language, it's a God of love for all people, not a God of judgment for some, and that life is meaningful, not meaningless. That's our voice that must be bellowed into the marketplace. And it begins, we got to practice it with each other. Because the only hope for the world is dialogue. That was certainly the point of those articles. We cope with these differences, and then when we're able to get a little bit of communication going, that's about as good as it gets. And we can't ignore that fact. Even Mitt Romney said, no movement of conscience can succeed in America that cannot speak to the convictions of religious people. And that's the fact of the matter. America is a religious nation. And even if it's only skillful means, we need to learn to communicate in those languages. Conversely, I would say Mr. Romney needs to remember when he gives his speech that not every person in America is a believer either. And the beautiful thing about the liberal umbrella is it makes room for that too. That's its very point, actually. I think if we can own that and begin to practice it together, we will find what our special gift to the world is, to be the listeners, to be the learners, and to be the translators across those religious language boundaries, one to another, sharing the real deep idea of the common good, not the sit around the table and don't talk about it version of liberalism. I just want us to take our own faith, whatever it is, however you see the world, I want you to take it seriously. I don't want it to be something that's as private as your food preferences or as, you know, that's real, but that's not meaningful. That's not the kind of thing that guides you in hard moral decision-making times. So wherever you're coming from, I want us to be free here to root ourselves in it deeply. Faith language, God language, no God language, what are you for? What do you believe in? Let's practice telling each other that thing, and I just think incredible energy will come out of that. Let's talk around the table. That's it for now.